Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Get in touch with technology with tech stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with How Stuff Works and iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And you are about to listen to a classic interview episode of Tech Stuff that was originally published on April 23rd, 2012. In this interview, we get to talk to one of my friends, Brian Brushwood, professional magician, techno wizard, you might say, and overall rogue. The guy has gone on to do numerous super cool things, including appearing on a Penn & Teller show and lots of other really awesome stuff. And this was a chance for us to chat with him way back in 2012. And it's great to hear him again, because I don't run into him very much. He lives out in Texas, so I don't get a chance to see him very frequently. But enjoy this episode of Tech Stuff Conjures Up Brian Brushwood.
Brian, thank you so much for being on our show.
Dude, thank you so much for having me. I mean, I know we've talked about this for months. I'm glad we finally made it happen.
Yeah, Brushwood and I are, we're like BFFs from way back.
Yeah, we're roomies.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. So, yeah, Brushwood is an amazing, amazing kind of guy. One of the nicest guys you guys could ever meet. I really do mean that, Mr. Brushwood.
You're going to ruin my reputation. Stop this.
All right. He's also a complete jerk. No. So we wanted to talk today about lots of different topics. But before we get started, in your own words, can we get sort of a minute long or 2 minute long bio of who you are, how you got interested in stage magic and technology and all that kind of good stuff?
Sure, man. It's really weird. I'm in a transition phase right now because if you'd asked me 5 years ago, the answer would have been dead simple. I would have told you I am a touring stage magician who tours colleges doing a punk rock magic show with fire eating escapes, mind reading. I stick a nail in one eye, it pops out the other eye. I break 30-pound bricks over my head. And that's all I did. But as I've transitioned, we launched Scam School. I pitched it 5 years ago, right around this time. And now it's 4 years strong, 220 episodes. And now I'm hosting four other podcasts as well. But I'm still doing the live stage shows. So my identity is kind of in transition right now as I do more performing in front of the camera instead of in front of audiences. And now it's even more complicated since we just launched the Scam School book, which hit number one in Canada and number three in the U.S. on the iTunes store on the day of launch. So now I guess throw author in the mix as well. How about that?
Huge props to you.
Great.
That's awesome. And you're also, the Scam School show has also been featured on Discovery.com.
Yeah, they apparently it was the awesomest thing because I guess Discovery.com had been talking with Revision 3 and they were talking about some kind of partnership for a while. But since nothing was confirmed, nobody at Revision 3 really told me because, you know, it's like they didn't want to tell me if there was nothing to tell. But I guess within minutes of the deal being finalized, Discovery.com threw the first episode up under their life section. And so I found out about it because somebody on Twitter was like, hey, were you just not going to tell us that you joined Discovery.com? And I'm like, what? And so I took over to take a look, and sure enough, there it is. And it seems to be very well received. I'm excited about it.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And as a, you know, as a friend and fan, I was very pleased to see that join our family here. And it was a surprise to me as well. I had no knowledge of any sort of Revision 3 work at that point, but I was very pleased to see you brought on board. Anytime I can see talented people who are good at entertaining and informing, it's always a pleasure. So we wanted to talk a little bit today about the fact that since you have extensive experience being a stage magician, that kind of gets your perspective on how stage magic has changed over the years and how the role of technology has sort of played a part in that, and that and just get an idea of what's important when you're a stage magician.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say as far back as you look, there's been a very tight relationship between technology and magic. And what's the Arthur C. Clarke quote from Childhood's End? He says, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yes, mm-hmm. One of our favorites.
Yeah, no, and the magicians love that quote because it makes us sound important. But you know, you look back and it seems like every time there's a novel new technology, there is a magician to either exploit it secretly in a stage show or to make it integral to his stage performance. You know, you go back, you got Jean-Eugène Robert Houdon doing bullet catches, you know, when, mm-hmm. and this is in the 19th century when they're still using musket type rifles. You got, you know, Penn and Teller doing cell phone tricks, or, you know, and of course I do an illusion in my stage show now where I make a ghost appear on everyone's cell phone in the audience. And there's something about the novelty of new technology that puts a finger in that same part of the brain that good sleight of hand does, where it's just incomprehensible and you can't even understand how that's possible.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. And, you know, not to pull back the veil too much, from the whole magic thing, but
go ahead, pull it back
in
all
the
naked back here
in the biz. You know, we might refer to certain types of technology specifically made for stage magic, often referred to as gimmicks, a gimmick that you use in order to pull off a trick. And I think it's an interesting thing that I see with a lot of people who just start off in magic, the beginners, often I think place more stock in a gimmick than they do necessarily in stage presentation. And I'm curious as to what your view is on that. What do you think is the most important tool in any stage magician's toolbox?
You nailed it right on the head. When I first started in magic, I was, 18 years old and wandered into a magic shop in Austin, Texas that was run out of the garage of one of the local magicians. And since I didn't have a car at university, I had to take two different buses. It took me 45 minutes just to go the 8 miles to get there. And this guy talked to me for like 3 hours straight. And I just had my mind blown because I had picked magic just out of the blue as a hobby to try. And I didn't really know much about it, But one of the things he told me that really stuck with me is like when people first start doing magic, they always want the self-working, no fail gimmicks. They want the tricky deck of cards to force someone a card rather than relying on sleight of hand, because, you know, it's a confidence booster and it's something that always works. But then there's some kind of guilt that builds in you and makes you think like, oh, I'm not really a magician. I should be doing everything with a real deck of cards. And you learn how to do these fancy forces or these flourishes, or, you know, turn over one card so it looks like a different card. And then after a while, once you have that down, you get lazy and say, why am I doing all this extra work when I'm the one who notices the difference? And then you go back to using gimmicks.
So it's a pendulum.
Yeah, it is. But you come out the other side, because it's one of those, once you get enough flight time, you build an engaging presentation. And I'll tell you, that's the biggest, I don't want to say betrayal, that's the biggest confusion that people have. A lot of folks get into magic when they're 14 and hitting puberty because they feel powerless and they want a way to get other people to be interested in something they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so they follow the script the way it's written. They do the moves the way it's written. And either they get stuck in that rut and they become those socially awkward people who can't relate to other people except with a deck of cards in their hand, or they pull through it and they realize, wow, it's not really, they'll realize, like, out of everything, the one joke they made up on the spot got a bigger reaction than any of the prepackaged canned jokes that they had before then. And then they realize that the magic is just that social lubricant. It's just that excuse to start interacting with someone. And it's really, it's your personality that matters way more than anything. And you, I mean, you, there are parts of Penn and Teller show that are utterly transparent to anyone who knows a thing or two about magic. And yet they are some of the most important, beautiful routines that they've ever written, because they speak to something bigger than the trick they're doing.
Yeah, I'm always reminded of their routine of doing the cups and balls with the transparent cups.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And even as you're watching it, and even as they're explaining how they do it, they're doing it so seamlessly and so smoothly that it's so clear that they've really polished that routine that it still feels like magic.
Well, I think there's a real there's something that we really crave in the illusion of being educated. And I say the illusion because by the time that trick, ostensibly the whole purpose of that routine is for them to teach you how to do the cups and balls, because you see it done with transparent cups. By the time that's over, I would challenge you to 100,000 yen that, what is that, 100 bucks?
Something that like that.
You could not recreate even one phase of that routine accurately. And likewise, one of the things people seem to like most in my stage show is I begin with this 4.5 minute illustrated history of fire eating, right? Explain from the earliest references to resistance to fire to the touring, stage performer Richardson in the 1600s. I explain the progression of fire eating, and everyone's, oh, I'm just so educational. I learned so much. And I was like, you cannot repeat back one fact I gave you that entire time. But it's that blend of feeling like you're learning while you're seeing something visually interesting that seems to sit well with people.
Excellent. Yeah. And it's interesting to me on this show in several different episodes, and Chris can attest to this because he had to listen to me do it just a second ago. I stress the importance of critical thinking and really taking time to think things through, because otherwise you just tend to accept stuff on a surface level and it becomes very easy to get tricked into things. This is one of those things that magicians actually can depend upon, depending on their routines. But there does seem to be an interesting relationship between people who get into stage magic and people who are advocates for critical thinking.
That all really began with Houdini. You know, Houdini was obsessed with trying to contact his dead mother. And this is at the height of spiritualism, mm-hmm. in the early 20th century. But being a magician, he was offended when he went to spiritual mediums and saw they were using standard sleight of hand tricks. And yet these people with the straight face were saying, no, I'm contacting the spirit world. He's like, no, you got that palm, and he would call them out. He was kind of an a-hole about it, you know?
Yeah. And that tradition continues to this day.
well, and to be honest, nobody was doing it after Houdini until James Randi came along. And back in the 1960s, it started off with I don't know if it started with $100 out of his own pocket or $1,000 out of his own pocket, but he's always offered this dollar amount challenge to anyone who can demonstrate any psychic, ESP, or supernatural phenomenon under double-blind test conditions, and nobody's gotten anywhere close. And in fact, the challenge is now, of course, the world-famous million-dollar challenge.
And it actually extends to things beyond your typical, you know, we typically think of things like being able to move something with your mind or prove that dowsing is real. But it actually, I've seen him extend that to technological claims as well. For example,
monster cables.
Yeah, there you go. That's where I was headed. You beat me to the punch there.
And I guess it's true. I think I read an article recently saying that a wire coat hanger demonstrated the ability to perform just as well as a $100 monster cable.
Yeah, we, as a matter of fact, talked about that on a previous podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
That exact same subject.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Which, it's interesting to think that it's a stage magician, someone who is skilled in the arts of deception,
yeah,
who comes forward as an advocate for this. But then again, you're talking about the people who know these tools, because like you were saying with Houdini, these are the tools of the trade, and they're seeing it being done not for entertainment purposes, but to pull the wool over the eyes and try and bilk people out of money.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, in a way, the people that sell paraphernalia like that, the high-end audio cables that work theoretically just as well as a coat hanger, they're involved in an act of showmanship as well.
Oh, certainly showmanship. And also, there's certain things, when there's a market need for something, whether it exists or not, somebody will figure out a way to fill it. And that's why I don't think monster cables are going anywhere, is because whether or not it's true, if you have more money than sense, you want to believe that there's something better than the $10 cable. And monster's going to be there to say, yes, there is. And here it is.
And the thing that really drives me crazy is you could actually come into contact with a system that is measurably, through very, very finely tuned instruments, better than a cheaper system, but to the human ear is indistinguishable.
Right.
Because we're not capable of hearing that.
Well, and in fact, there's a man, it was over a decade ago that I read in Wired magazine, I wish I could remember the name of the audio engineer, that he set up a super calibrated sound system at one dance club, and people were complaining that it just wasn't loud. And meanwhile, he's looking at the decibel meter, and this thing's like almost damaging their hearing. It's so loud. So he goes to Radio Shack and gets I think it was like a 25 cents impeater that would clip the highest end. But the audio cue of hearing the high ends being clipped made them think that the speakers were maxed. And even though the volume was actually lower, people reported how much more they liked the music, how much louder it was.
I don't find that hard to believe, but it is pretty amazing.
It is amazing. I'll tell you, man, it's amazing to me what a mystery our own minds are. And that's one of the things, one of the greatest things I got to do at the University of Texas was I was part of this honors program where they only took 150 students each year, and they'd have over 1,000 applicants. But you took pretty much what they told you the first couple of years. But the last 2 years, you took whatever classes were related to your thesis. You had to have a thesis in order to graduate. And some of the students would write their first novel. Some of them would write these 200-300 page biographies on obscure figures from history. And I was doing magic on the side at this point. And I thought, well, maybe it would be awesome if I could get away with writing a paper on the history of magic, because that would be fun. Or even better, if I could claim that it was my thesis to get a trick published in one of these magic journals. So, you know, still putting a significant amount of work on myself, but at least it would be fun and magic related. And when I went in to pitch my idea to the dean, she said, well, what do you want to do for your thesis? And I got as far as saying, well, for the last couple of years, I've been doing magic on the side. And as I drew in a breath to continue, she interrupted saying, and you want to do a magic show as a creative writing thesis. What a great idea. And so as a result, I got to take whatever courses I wanted for the last 2 years, as long as I could justify it being related to magic. So I took courses on, on artificial intelligence, on psychology, on history of witchcraft, on pseudoscience and the paranormal. It was amazing. But it was those courses on brain development that really cemented in my mind what wonderful flawed machines we all are. And once you spend a few years deceiving people, and even better, hearing back from people after the fact, having them describe to you what they think you did or what they remember you doing, it is unreal how wrong all of our memories are all the time on everything. And once you accept that, I find I'm a lot happier about everything. I don't argue anymore. Like if I remember something happening one way and someone remembers it another way, I'm like, ah, whatever. We're probably both wrong. Yeah. Probably something like that. And likewise, when you look at, eyewitness testimony, you devalue it severely because you understand that even if they're not intentionally lying to themselves, there's just no way that they can accurately remember anything.
So you're making me feel a lot more comfortable about the fact that I offload a lot of my own mental mental practices onto my technology now.
Oh, you should. You should. And in fact, I think that we're entering an age where, unfortunately, in the legal system right now, we still are in a place where we value eyewitness testimony far more than we should. Mm-hmm. Because if you're familiar with the work of Elizabeth Loftus, it is unreal. They've been able to induce false memories in other people by asking leading questions. Mm-hmm. There was one story where they took a young kid named Chris and they laid out five stories. Four of them were tales that actually happened to him. One was a totally made up story about being lost at the mall. And they asked a bunch of questions about all five. And then like 2 weeks later, they said, well, one of these was a made up story that never happened to you, Chris. Which one was the one that we made up? And he picked an actual story from his past as being a made up one because he couldn't believe that he wasn't lost at the mall at age five.
It's kind of like, wasn't there that story about the other experiment with the showing an ad, a fake ad for some popcorn to some people during a thing? And then like a survey 2 weeks later, they asked them how the popcorn was. But no one in the study had actually had any popcorn, but they all remembered trying it and that it was delicious because of the ad.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I haven't heard that one.
No, that was in 2011 when I heard that. I think I heard that on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And this is why focus groups aren't so great for marketing purposes.
Yeah.
Because the leader often sort of steers it in the direction of the company that has organized this focus group is trying to achieve. Like, oh, hey, look, it works.
Yeah.
So
right.
Just go with it.
Yeah. Which
well,
kind
of... That's the importance of double blind experimentation, which we, you know, of course, they do very, very well with the FDA and for you know, new drugs. But
right.
When it comes to consumer marketing, there's probably not much of a reason to try that.
And for those out there who don't know what a double blind test is, all right, so a blind test means that the person who's taking the test has no knowledge of whether or not they are in a control group or the test group. Double blind is that the person administering the test also does not know if they are administering a test to the control group or to the test group.
Yeah.
So that it limits the chance that data will be leaked to a test subject and influence his or her results.
Yeah, that one of the earliest cases of that where it's so important is Michel-Eugène Chevreul, who's a French scientist, and this is back in the, I believe, the 19th century when dowsing was super popular. And dowsing is, of course, you know, finding water with a forked stick or holding a pendulum over a substance and it swings one way if it's supposed to be one thing or swings another way if it's another. And when he tried it, he set out a bowl of mercury, held out the pendulum, and the thing started swinging like crazy. He pulled the mercury away, and it stayed totally still. And he was like, holy crap, maybe there's something to this. Although he didn't say that because he was French. He was like, sacré crap.
Exactly, sacré crap.
But he had the idea. He had his assistant set up a partition, and he just held out the pendulum, and the assistant would either set down an empty bowl or a bowl filled with mercury, and once he didn't know which one it was, it didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that James Randi had suggested a similar test where it would involve burying PVC pipes with water in them, for example, under a certain area of land, covering it all up, and then the person administering the test would have no idea where the PVC pipe actually was. They would just observe the test subjects as they would walk across, and the test subjects would let them know if they had found a hit or not, and that would be a typical, very simple double blind test, although the actual administration would require more, but...
out of everybody who goes for the James Randi $1 million prize, the dowsers seem to be the most intense because they truly believe what they're doing is a science. And the reason they truly believe it is because they have so many stories of personal validation where they looked for water pipes behind the wall and they found them. They looked for water at their uncle's farm and they found it. Or, you know, they look for a lost object and they find it. And the problem is, you can be right. You can get lucky and you can maybe you rely on your intuition and not realize you're doing that. So even if they're right and get a hit, that doesn't mean that it proves that dowsing works. It means that it proves that that either, you know, one of the other things happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And this kind of leads us in this whole belief, the fact that we are fallible constructs. You know, we make mistakes and often we don't realize we're making the mistakes and that there are ways of tweaking that. That kind of leads into the discussion I wanted to have about social engineering. Now you have your show Scam School, which has a lot to do with social engineering. Can you explain to our listeners what is social engineering?
Oh, I think the definition is clinically something like, you know, a set of tools designed to induce a certain response in people in certain environments. I just claim that it's cheap, dirty psychological tricks to get people to do what you want.
Right.
But whether it's, you know, and on Scam School, we try to keep it light. So more often than not, we explain the ways that you can use, you know, magic tricks or psychological manipulation to get the girl's phone number or to win free beers off of your friends. One of the best experiences that I got to have was, 3 years ago, I got selected at South by Southwest to give a keynote presentation on social engineering, scam your way into anything or from anyone. And in the research putting together on that, I read a number of books, including Robert Cialdini's Influence, which is fantastic. So many amazing tidbits in there that are all based on, you know, real psychological surveys, stuff like there's these fixed action patterns, these psychological backdoors that anyone from con artists to magicians can use to make people feel obligated to do certain things. For example, reciprocation. There was a Dennis Regan did this fake art experiment where he had a group of people come in and they were assigned in twos. Now, one of them was a real experimentee. The other was a fake experimentee. And they spent all day reviewing art on a scale of 1 to 5. I love it. I hate it. This, that, and the other. And about halfway, it was time to take a break. And so Mr. Fake Tester goes off to the bathroom. And when he comes back, one of two things would happen. Either he came back empty-handed and they just went back to work, or he came back with two Cokes in his hand. And he would say, hey, I went to the bathroom and I grabbed myself a Coke and I figured I'd grab one for you. Here you go. Enjoy a Coke. And then they go back to testing. And then at the very end of the day, Mr. Fake Tester would, in both groups, say, hey, I hate to bug you about this, but we're doing this raffle for work. And if I sell enough, there's a chance I could win a car. As many as you could buy, the more the better. And they measured how many of these tickets he would sell. And under reciprocation, people bought either 2 or 3 times as much as they did without reciprocation. Now, some people say, like, okay, well, maybe when they gave him a Coke, they liked the guy more, and that's why they went ahead and bought more tickets. But it turns out that wasn't the case. Exit surveys showed that even if they actively disliked the Mr. Fake Tester, they still bought 2 or 3 times more than they would without reciprocation.
Socially impelled to buy those tickets.
Yeah. And it's that we hate owing people anything. And there's other things like social proof. There's the idea that the trappings of authority force people to comply, even if that authority is just a well-tailored suit. They did studies where they measure how many people would follow when somebody started jaywalking. And if that person was just wearing work clothes, there would be, you know, X number of people would start following if he started jaywalking. But when it was a guy in a suit, 3 times as many people would follow him.
Yeah, I remember when I was in high school, I remember seeing a demonstration where I just thought it was incredibly cruel at the time, but it was a fast talker. It was a guy who just spoke in jargon, meaningless jargon, and demonstrating how social pressures would make people agree to things even if they had no idea what was being said, and would demonstrate it by bringing someone who was unaware of the fact that he was, you know, just a flim-flam guy, you know, thought that he was introduced to him as if he were an expert in a particular subject. And then he just started having this conversation and saying that after it was over, said, well, the reason why she never stopped me to ask what was going on is there's this social pressure on her to act like she understands it. And, you know, it would be mortifying to admit that you don't know what someone meant when they said something to you in front of a crowd of other people.
Yes. Well, and in fact, that's probably the biggest component of what makes stage hypnosis possible. People always ask whether or not hypnosis is real or not. It's like it's real to the extent that you believe it's real. But the biggest factor is the ability, you'll notice that most hypnosis shows begin with very small tests, and it's very clear that this is a test. Like, I'm telling you what to do, and imagine this, and react as if it's real. And then he says, imagine this. And at some point, he stops saying imagine, but instead he just says, now you're hot, and now you start acting like you're hot because that's what you've been doing. And then he says, now you're cold, and now you're fanning yourself, or you're shivering because you're cold. And then he just starts setting up scenes, and at some point you've entered this contract where he says what to do and you act it out, and at some point you realize 20 minutes in that you're committed 100%, and the only way out is to ruin the show.
Yeah.
And stuff, and be like, I'm not hypnotized. So it's like and hypnosis is real in that there's no way I could just walk up to somebody and say, hey, get on stage and pretend to be Lady Gaga. They'd be like, no, absolutely not. But hypnosis is real in that it is a construct that creates a situation where somebody goes way outside of their comfort zone, because that is a safer choice than blowing up and ruining the stage show. And on top of that, there is I don't want to take away from stage hypnotist, because there is an aspect to it where people, when they vividly imagine something strong enough, it does induce a physical response. If you've ever been to a movie and laughed or cried, you know, you're crying about a person who never existed and a thing that never happened, but you make it real in your mind. You know, that's as real as hypnosis is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to tell you, Brian, that if you ever ask me to get up on stage and pretend to be Lady Gaga, that's a pact I am willing to make with you right here and now.
Good.
Because, you know, no hypnosis necessary. You have sold, sir.
We have more Brian Brushwood goodness to come, but first, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4. Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The reason why I wanted to bring up social engineering is that it's not just important in things like stage magic, but also that's one of those tools that a lot of people we call hackers use in order to get access to secure systems. It has nothing to do with sitting down at a computer, typing in three different passwords, and the third one's the one that works, despite the way Hollywood would have us believe. But more frequently has something to do with befriending someone or posing as a maintenance worker of some sort and just engineering your way through people to get access to secure systems, because that's way easier than trying to figure out how to break through a technological secure system.
Yeah, absolutely. If you think of technology as a sealed room, I mean, you could either try to pick that lock, or you could beat down the door, or you could just ask nicely for the person behind the counter to open it for you. Yes. And obviously, there's a lot of people where that last one works best. And the far and away, the best example of this is if you haven't read the original book, Catch Me If You Can, mm-hmm. It's way better. The movie was fine, but the book is unreal because it's actually written in the voice of Frank Abagnale, very honestly talking about his exploits, you know, over the 2 or 3 years that he flew all around the world cashing over $1 million in bogus checks. That's one where it's a case where he realized that wearing the trappings of authority by looking like a doctor or looking like a pilot, he was able to pass checks that otherwise would never pass muster. People would be like, this is obviously bogus. Get out of here. Call the cops. But when it's a pilot, you know, held in such high regard, people just shut up and cashed him.
Yeah, and Kevin Mitnick's book too that came out recently has been doing well, and I think it's the same thing as the person just explaining what he was doing at the time. Also, I just as an aside that we probably shouldn't get into, I find it kind of amusing that we're talking about social engineering in an election year here in the United States.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, that's boy. I mean, you'll see all kinds of trappings of authority. That's why part of the reason the little things, like people can't wait to get to that level of success where they can have the Secret Service around them, because that starts to reinforce the idea that this candidate's important, and it starts to reaffirm that the trappings of authority become as important as actual authority.
Yeah, I'm just waiting to reach that level of success where I can get a decent table at a restaurant. That's. I like to set realistic goals.
I'll tell you what, man. It is unreal what one phone call will do in front of me. My friend Dan Martin is one of these guys who scams his way into upgrades left and right. He picks up the phone and pretends to be his own manager. He gives another name and says, you know, I'm the manager for Daniel Martin. You've probably seen him on, lists a bunch of different stuff. And, of course, nobody wants to admit that they don't know who the hell Dan Martin is.
Right.
And they're like, oh, yes, no, that's great. And he's like, well, listen, here's the thing. He's got a very important client that he's trying to impress. We understand there's an hour and a half wait. Is there any way you guys can take care of us? And and sure enough, you know, and I've seen him do it where we skipped an hour long line to go to the steakhouse. We sit down. And then the management comes over and says, oh, thank you, Mr. Martin. We're so glad to have you here. I understand you have a celebrity guest. And without missing a beat, he turns to my assistant at the time, Captain MG, we called him, this big, tall guy. He's just like, yeah, you probably seen him in the office. He's one of the guys who works down in the warehouse. And instantly people are like, oh, I think I do remember you in a couple of episodes. Because, again, nobody wants to admit that they don't remember the guy. And Dan's whole idea is like, look, man, I'm doing these people a favor. They're going to go home and talk about the celebrity.
Oh, gosh. Oh, this reminds me of a story my dad tells. So my dad's a science fiction author and an English professor, and occasionally would teach a stint down at the Governor's Honors Program, which in Georgia is a program that selects I think it's around between 600 and 700 high school students to study for a summer in very focused groups, depending upon, you know, whatever their major is for that program. I actually went in communicative arts, which was, you know, English back in 1992. But before that, my dad was teaching there in the 80s. And he tells a story about how he and some of the other teachers went to, I think it was like a International House of Pancakes or something like that, some sort of diner. And they walked in, and one of their fellow teachers is an African-American fellow who wore traditional African garments occasionally. And they just decided on a whim as they walked in that he was a visiting dignitary from Africa.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he put on the whole role of it and even went so far as saying, these greets, what is greets? I will take greet. I said, oh, honey, you're going to need more than one. But yeah, they tell the whole story about how they ended up, the check was picked up. And dad's the sort where it was a very funny story, but you could tell there was still that little bit of guilt.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem with magic in general, is there's some part of me that is compelled. I think that's part of why scam school is good for my soul, because I don't want to be that jerk who goes around letting people believe he has wizard powers. And there's some part of me that wants to tell everyone it's all a lie.
Yeah, which is why I really do respect stage magicians who go out of their way to say, all right, I'm going to perform an illusion for you. And, you know, it's very clear that they're telling you up front. And they said, but if you're willing to go with me on this trip, you're going to see something amazing. And
yes.
And I mean, Penn and Teller do some great stuff where they even go so far as to say, you could question how we do it, but if you learn the answer, then it just sort of takes away from the performance. The question we wish you would ask us is, why do we do it?
Yeah.
I'm like, wow.
what's the quote that the magicians say? Magicians are guarding an empty vault. Like, whatever it is you think the method is way more fantastic than how it actually is. Yeah. Nothing but disappointment lay on the other side of that vault door. Except there are a few cases where the actual method is even more interesting than the trick itself. And once that's true, then by all means, teach the entire thing. And in fact, it used to be the very first episode of Scam School we did was something called the Human Chimney, where you essentially make smoke appear from nowhere out of your lungs. And it got great reactions when I did it, but everybody thought the method everybody assumed was happening was not nearly as interesting as the science behind what happens when you secretly inhale this poisonous white phosphor, and the white phosphor saps out all of the moisture out of your lungs, creating this super thick water vapor. And once I found that I get much more joy and a bigger reaction out of people by explaining how it's done and encouraging them to try it, because it's interesting when a magician can make smoke appear out of the lungs. It's magic when somebody can do it to themselves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I've even heard magicians talk about how they would see someone do like some close-up magic, and they would just, you know, they knew a way of doing it, and that was immediately what they go to. They assume that that's the way. And then when it's demonstrated that there's a different way, and it might be an incredibly difficult and complex way that requires lots more practice than the simple way, but stage magicians say, wow, that was amazing.
As a matter of fact, the fantastic performer Tom Mullica is a legend in magic. He's one of the most talented sleight of hand artists out there, and he's got that gift of personality and charisma. And he did this, he has this like 3.5 minute routine where he appears to eat one by one an entire box of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually heavy and these are lit cigarettes. He lights them all, he smokes them all at once. He has this, you know, it's like that Homer Simpson photo of the mouth full of cigarettes.
Yeah.
He does that and then appears to swallow all of them. And there's heavy duty, awesome sleight of hand going on in there. But he goes to FISM. And if you don't know, FISM is like the Olympics of magic. They have it, I think, every third or second year. A couple years ago, it was in China. But he goes to FISM and just totally bombs, because all of the judges just assume this guy's a freak who just swallowed a bunch of lit cigarettes. Nobody knew it was magic. And as a result, he didn't win.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
That's almost an accolade awesome enough all on its own.
I'm sure, yeah. That's part of it. I'm sure that's why the story's being told.
Well, to transition out of this, I wanted to talk more about some of the other projects you've worked on, some of which are closely related to technology. In fact, one of these we've talked about on our show in the past, and I think I might have even talked about this before I met you, which is the whole idea of leaving behind a virtual ghost.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I think it might have been before we had met each other.
Yeah, that's the afterlife.me project. We don't really have anything up there, but if you want to sign up to be notified when it's I'm going to make sure it's actually still live here before. That's afterlyfe.me, afterlife.me. It's the nuts and bolts are being tinkered with by Patrick Delahanty, who's a super talented web developer. And you're starting to see similar projects pop up, but all of them, they're all sanctimonious. And they're all like, you know, we're here to help with the grieving process, and we're here to clean up your data after you pass away. Afterlife.me is freaking honest. Afterlife.me is an opportunity to become a virtual ghost just to annoy and freak out everyone for the rest of eternity. And essentially what happens is it's a dead man switch where every year on your birthday, you log in and let it know you're alive. And of course it'll bug you by email to tell you to, make sure to check in. But if it doesn't hear back, it assumes you're dead. And then it takes all of your past tweets and just starts repeating them on the same times at the same dates that you said it year after year. And what I love about this isn't that what ghosts are in history? Are items that don't know they're dead, these echoes that think they're going about the daily business of their life when they're not. And the idea that we could do that digitally forever, you know, it's like picking up the kids, Merry Christmas, everyone, all the birthday in the bank, you know, all these things that you say year after year can become these digital echoes for all eternity. I think it's really cool as an art project. And, some people say it's tacky. Yes, it very likely is, but a lot of art can be tacky. And I think it's really cool performance art.
Personally, I love it. I mean, I just love the idea of someone reading a tweet and saying, oh, Jonathan's been dead for 20 years and he's still slamming the iPad.
Yeah. Well, and think about this. Well, and that'll be the other thing, too. It's like it'll be more hilarious to hear you talking about stuff that,
that doesn't
like Amy Winehouse died. You know, I think that'll become funny over time. But also think about the at replies where all of a sudden you whisper happy birthday to someone from 5 years after the fact.
This just tells me that I just need to make a lot more younger friends.
That's right.
Because I do want to irritate people after. I do it while I'm alive. Why would I want to stop after I'm dead? I want to irritate people. So, yes. Yeah, no, it's a great idea. As soon as I heard it, I completely appreciated it for what it was. Being sort of a mischievous prank puller myself, I found it incredibly appealing.
There's still some interview left, but before we get there, let's take another quick break to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at Concur.com. That's CONCUR.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's CONCUR.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So why don't we talk about, you can talk about some of the other shows you do, because we haven't really covered any of those. You've got some stuff on the Twit Network, for example. And yeah. Also, you, I do want to hear more about your experience with the Scam School ebook, please.
Yeah, well, Scam School, of course, is the big coming out party that I had for, with the internet. But a lot of people were surprised when it turns out I knew anything about technology as well. My past life, I spent a year testing video games for Rockwell Semiconductors for a year, which was awesome. And then I spent almost 3 years at Dell and their high-end sales support, you know, designing networks for small businesses or building high-end systems for, you know, 3D modelers, animators, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's the first time I did This Week in Tech. It just seemed like a natural fit. And Leo was nice enough to give me a number of shows to do. And now I'm doing three programs over there, including NSFW is an utterly volatile powder keg where we never know what's going to happen. Half the time it blows up in our face. Every so often we have moments of awesome hilarity. It's a very weird show because it's almost openly hostile to new people trying to visit it. So if you don't understand what's going on, just give it a couple more episodes and see if it sinks in.
Yeah,
it's kind of like your head with a hammer. It feels really good.
Anytime stuff. You have Justin Robert Young involved, there's going to be volatility.
Exactly, exactly. And then I started hosting a Frame Rate with Tom Merritt, which is a whole show about this whole emerging space with new media. Mm-hmm. This is, in many ways, the most exciting time to be a broadcaster or be somebody who's interested in reaching a large audience of all time, because essentially we're seeing exactly now the exact same thing that happened in the 1950s with broadcast television and then in the 1970s. With cable television, when broadcast television began, there was no market because nobody had TVs. Nobody knew what to do and nobody had any money. So they just took their radio figures and threw them in front of a screen. And then they figured out that television is a different medium than these other things, and they were able to tell their own unique stories in their own unique ways. Same thing happened in the 70s with cable. Nobody was watching. So all of a sudden there's all this bandwidth, all these channels. People are just throwing stuff. Ted Turner takes his local TBS, WTBS station and calls it a superstation. But then all of a sudden it becomes TBS, this powerhouse. Same thing with CNN. It wasn't even possible to have a 24-hour news network beforehand. So nowadays we're in the wild west of new media with just distribution from YouTube, with podcasting, with pretty much anyone who's got a story to tell now has a global opportunity to reach an audience worldwide, and it costs them nothing. There's no barrier to access, and it's this awesome land rush to see who can become king of which little circuits out there, because whoever gets there first has a huge advantage. That's the reason CNN was number one for so long, was because it was the first 24-hour cable network, and it was everyone else was just couldn't top it.
Mm-hmm.
And so likewise, that was the big push for why I did Scam School. So anyway, that's what Frame Rate is about the emerging digital transition, watching some new media stars transition to television and vice versa. And of course, now we're hosting Game On Twit, which is every Sunday night live. We talk about video game news and reviews.
Yep, and that's with Veronica Belmont.
Yes. I should lead off with that, because everyone likes to me, and that's fine.
Yeah, it's, you know, Veronica, I love her. She has shot me the look of death at least three times in my life, and I have survived, so.
I got it once or twice myself.
There's a hair trigger, you know? Just tread on the right ground.
I don't want to get in trouble, but one of my favorite things about hosting Game On is seeing the Veronica Belmont that will never show herself on the internet. She is delightfully, hilariously crass.
She is a wonderful person, and that's all I'm going to say about this because I'm hosting this show. Brian Brushwood had other things to say, but Jonathan Strickland just loves her. All right, so now that we've got that clear, so tell us more about this ebook.
Oh, my God. So for years, I've been flapping my gums about how I want to do a book for the Scam School book. And originally I had all these designs on a physical book that would have like magic-y kind of properties to it. The problem, of course, is that physical media, unless you get picked up by a big publisher who wants to invest $100,000, it's extremely, the development costs are high. The printing costs are high, especially if you want to do something non-standard or tricky with the pages. And you miss out on what's great about Scam School, because, of course, we have all these episodes, and the only way to get from a book to an episode would be like a kludgy kind of QR code thing. And have you ever used that? Have any of you guys ever read a book that had QR codes and actually pulled out your phone and clicked on it and went to the page?
Once or twice, but, you know, it's definitely there's a barrier there. It's just like with podcasts and suggesting, like, we tell in our podcast for people to go and read the articles on how stuff works. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of challenging because, you know, it's two different separate media. So to tell someone to go and read this article, and the article is amazing and that it goes into far more detail than we ever could in a podcast and has, you know, visual effects and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
It's a smaller number of people who make that transition. We love those people. And we would love that number to grow, but we understand it's two different media. And often, you know, what you're doing in one instance is not really, there's no way to port it over easily. Like if I'm mowing the lawn and listening to a podcast, I'm obviously not going to jump online and read an article about, you know, quantum suicide.
Exactly. So it's one of those things where it's like you need to have as smooth a transition as possible. And about 2 years ago, when Kindle really started to get more popular, and of course iTunes started up their iBook store, I was like, oh, dude, then it's got to be eBooks. And so we converted some of my old books to eBooks, and we figured out really fast what a nightmare this entire industry is in right now. Mm-hmm. As far as like proper formatting, you got competing formats, .mobi, .epub, they handle stuff differently. They have different capabilities. In .mobi, the Kindle format, it's not even possible to wrap text around an image. Mm. All you can have is text, block, here's an image. And you can't control the size of it. It'll reformat stuff. It was so difficult to try to build this tool that I really became disheartened as far as ever reaching that goal of what I wanted to do, of have something that was rich media, that was detailed, that was pretty, that was highly interactive and had embedded media content. But then along comes this company, Vook, that's VOOK.com. And they essentially are trying to create their own platform that once you create the book in Vook, you press publish and it converts it to .mobi, .epub, and it sends it out to Barnes & Noble, to Amazon, and to iTunes. So with one-click publishing, you're able to create really good-looking ebooks and with rich embedded media. And so we participated in their beta program, which was a little bit harrowing because there were times where the entire book would vanish or chapter would suddenly disappear. We get on the phone. We're like, what's going on? They're like, don't worry. We'll fix it.
It's magic.
Exactly. Like it's beta. But by the time we were done with the book, I was extraordinarily proud of it. It is unlike any other ebook I've seen in that it's almost like a Harry Potter book where the pictures and illustrations come alive. There's 70 audio commentary. I've never seen audio commentary tracks for chapters in a book before. And it's amazing because the book itself is a collection of 80 plus tricks from the Scam School series. These are all things that are either street cons to watch out for or ways to score a free drink, some kick-ass magic tricks, and a few really nasty pranks to pull on your friends. And I love the media format because I can spend two paragraphs explaining how to hold your pinky when you're holding a deck of cards. But none of that's as useful as when you press on the photo and all of a sudden it comes alive and illustrates animated for you and shows you exactly what you're supposed to do. So it's got 70 plus audio commentary tracks and 40 plus illustrations. And out of everything, I'm most pleased with the fact that Teller of Penn and Teller allowed me to publish an essay he wrote me 17 years ago when I was 19 years old. And looking for my place in magic, I wrote a letter to Teller, and he was kind enough to write a response, like a four-page essay.
Wow.
Talking about creativity and magic, and being able to publish that and share the word on that has been extremely gratifying. So I am very, very happy. If you go to scamschoolbook.com, you can find all the different platforms.
Fantastic. Yeah, and that is exciting to me because, you know, we've been talking about this whole electronic book medium and what the potential is, and that it's been several years in the making, and it's so exciting that it looks like now we're getting to the point where people are actually really cracking that nut, where they've managed to find a way to incorporate the different abilities you have in something like a web-based presence and the the things you have within electronic text, and that it's being brought together in ways to really cater to a wider audience, really. Because, I mean, we all know that people favor different ways to learn information. You know, some people, some people reading text, that's what they like. And some people, they have to see it work for it to really have an impact. And
this is, I was going to say, this is an important phase we're entering with ebooks, where just as we figured out that television is not radio with pictures, ebooks are not books on your iPad. It's an inherently different platform with different strengths and weaknesses. And I honestly feel like the Scam School book is the first book on the shelves, you know, this minute, that truly takes advantage of that unique nature and speaks the language of digital ebooks. And the reviews seem to indicate that that there is something special happening there.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I mean, I think the next, if I were to put on my prognosticator hat, I would say the next step as far as the medium starting to come into its own, the ebook is what's happening now. I think the next step is augmented reality, because right now we're seeing it used in things like commercials and that kind of stuff, or games. But the idea of having a world of information overlaid on top of the real world around you and anchoring that information in the world to give it real and impactful meaning to the person who's looking at it, and whatever context that might be, because there could be endless number of contexts for any particular region. That to me, that's why I keep on, whenever I get an opportunity, I keep on mentioning Google. If you're making those glasses, I want a pair.
Absolutely.
In fact, I have to work that in.
I fully believe that you're already seeing this in the military, mm-hmm. the video gamification of your job. And they are, I don't know, I guess the military really pioneered the idea of badges and medals and achievements. But you know, of course, we see it in stuff like World of Warcraft when you're grinding all the time. And a friend of mine is now he was a CEO of a company. He put together a business plan to try to pitch the idea of an achievement-based system for all of his employees based on their class and their missions or their tasks, where they could level up and get perks, they could win badges. The whole thing was clearly modeled right after World of Warcraft, and he I don't know if he ever implemented it, but it was so obviously right when I read it that I fully expect us to see more companies running their businesses
and that wraps
like a video
up this
game.
Classic episode, our conversation with Brian Brushwood. Brian is an awesome dude. If you don't know him, you should definitely look up his work. He's got several YouTube series that date back for years. He shows you all these awesome magic tricks that you can learn how to do and really impress friends, as well as things like bar bets and that kind of stuff. Lots of really fun social engineering as well. So make sure you go check those out. And if you have any suggestions for future episodes of Tech Stuff, well, send me an email. The address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or drop on over to our website. That's techstuffpodcast.com. You'll find the archive of shows there, as well as our links to social media sites. And, of course, the link to our store. Every purchase you make at our store goes to help the show. We greatly appreciate it. And I'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.